I'm speaking today with State Representative Pete Gallego, who is now running for Congress, the Democratic nomination for Congress in District 23. Representative Gallego, thank you for talking to me today. Why are you running for this office?
Oh, the pleasure is mine. Thank you for the invitation. I am running for office really to try to bring some balance back into the federal government and to have the opportunity to inject a little bit of common sense. There are three kinds of examples. I mean, I think the skills that I bring are the skills of conciliation. My role in the legislature has been to bring various factions together and to create some middle ground, which I think Congress desperately needs. And frankly, I am one of those who was taught that you can't complain unless you're willing to participate. And there's so much to complain about up there. There's so many things going wrong. But we need some people who are willing to put all of those kinds of political fights aside and concentrate on the substance of the issue, which has always been my forte.
Okay. Now, you've been in the Texas legislature since, I believe, 1990. Talk to me a little bit about what your experience has been and some of the things that you would say are your best accomplishments from the legislature.
Well, I've been in the legislature a long time. You know, I've had the opportunity to do a lot of things that make a difference. As an example, I'm chairman of criminal jurisprudence, as an example. So that area, I was a prosecutor before I got to the House, has always been important to me. If you've ever watched a criminal case or read a story on a criminal proceeding, and at the end the victim is given an opportunity to make a statement, that legislation and the enabling legislation for what is now known as the Texas Crime Victims Bill of Rights, those kinds of things were what I was passionate about. Those I authored those bills. If you know kids, for example, who have prosthetic devices, the only health insurance mandate that Texas has passed while the Republicans have been in office and in control has been a mandate that I passed, which required health insurance companies to provide prosthetic devices for little kids, because as a parent of a seven-year-old, for example, it was very difficult to watch other kids who were 15, but they had the prosthetic devices from when they were six or seven, because the insurance companies would only cover one prosthetic device for the entire life of the child. So, you know, those kinds of things that make a difference in real life, whether it was investing in public schools as a member of the Conference Committee on Appropriations for the 10 years that I was one of five people who got to direct state spending, infrastructure improvements in places that I represented. I mean, those kinds of things that make real difference in the lives of working Texans, that's what I take the most pride in.
Okay. You know, criminal justice issue. I mean, as you said, you were the chair of the Criminal Justice Committee this last session in the legislature. Criminal justice issues, you know, they do come up in Congress, but they don't tend to be very high profile unless it's related to, like, national security or occasionally to, you know, like downloading movies or something. You know
the similarity, though, is there's so much passion involved in criminal justice issues from both sides. And the ability to bridge the difference between the constitutional rights of the defendant and the emotion, the raw emotion of the victim or the victim's family, that's kind of the strength of mine. And you know, as an example, this last session, where I was pretty passionate about the issue of violence and how we cannot make a mistake in prosecuting, and that we have to be sure that when we put somebody away, for life or otherwise, that it's actually the right person who committed the crime. And so lineups were really one of our biggest issues. And so working with Rodney Ellis as an example to pass the bill that really tightened up how and standardized how Texas police departments make these the decisions to go forward on a lineup and creating a uniform procedure. procedure, which nobody had ever had before, to make sure that we minimize.
Well, it's, you know, it's interesting. There's been a lot of attention paid lately to crime labs and forensics and the standards that they are held to. It seems that most of these are set by states and in some cases, I think, even by localities. There's not a uniform standard, and there's been a lot of research done lately that calls into question some fairly well-accepted issues of, you know, criminal forensics, like even fingerprints. Where I'm going with this is that it seems like, you know, it might be time for there to be some, you know, standards set at the federal level for what constitutes good forensic science in the criminal justice system. Is that something, you know, that you think you would be, that you would work on as a member of Congress?
Well, I will tell you that for the most part, I'm a big believer in letting the states handle their own business. There are some areas where you do want uniform laws or standardization. And probably this is an area where we should at least consider that, making sure that whether you are in New York or California or Florida or Texas, that justice is evenly dispensed. And so it's something that definitely should be considered. Texas is definitely moving its standards up, and with the advent of some additional resources to the Department of Public Safety and some additional requirements for labs, I mean, we're definitely moving in the right direction here. But it's something that we need to get the other states to make sure that they keep up. Because frankly, I can think of nothing more important than individuals. We talk about liberty, and putting people in prison for the wrong thing, or putting innocent people in prison, actually, is what I meant to say. Putting innocent people in prison, I can think of no greater violation of that right to liberty than for the government to keep people imprisoned who are factually innocent. So whatever we can do with those crime labs to make sure that the evidence is accurately assessed, I think every opportunity needs to be taken advantage of to get to that standard.
District 23 includes some parts of the state that were hit pretty hard by the drought last year and that are still feeling very strongly the effects of the drought. You know, is there a federal response that needs to be made to this, or is this something that Texas has to handle on its own?
Well, I think, there's some FEMA assistance for places. I think there's some federal agencies that are involved in helping. I mean, certainly with the wildfire response in West Texas, there were a significant number of the federal agencies involved, and a lot of help came in from other places. It wasn't just Texas firefighters fighting, but we need to look at the overall response of making sure that the federal government actually follows through on its commitment. I think it's very important.
District 23 also includes a number of border counties along the Rio Grande. What does comprehensive immigration reform and border security, what do those things look like to you? What do those terms mean to you?
You know, I think comprehensive immigration reform has several pieces. The first is you've got to figure out what you're going to do. I don't think it's that hard to create a system where the system can contract and expand with market demand. Because I represent, as you indicated, the biggest state rep district along the border, and hoping to represent the largest congressional district, we've got significant experience with the border, and we know that when it comes time to pick onions in Presidio or cantaloupes in Vegas, that you really need a lot of labor. Or when it comes time for the local ranchers to do their roundups, they need significant help. And there's not that many U.S. citizens who are taking taking advantage of the opportunities to do that kind of work. So you create a system that expands and contracts with the market. And after they have been able to work here for a particular amount of time and have had no incidents, have had no trouble with the law, have had no violations, then it seems to me that those people who work hard and who want to contribute to the American experience and the American society, those are the people that you want. And so those people, you give them over time an opportunity to become citizens. And by the same token, in the meantime, you also create a system where if people say, you know, you need to apply for citizenship and you need to follow the law, you need to stand in line, that's okay too. But you actually have to create a line, because right now that line isn't really working very well, and the reason that people are doing what they do is because there isn't really much of a line. I mean, that system, that immigration system is totally broken. So recreating that. And at the same time, you need the law enforcement piece, because you have to create a situation where people, not only those who live along the border, but it's very important for them, where they feel safe and secure in their homes. You make sure that the violence that you're seeing along the Texas-Mexico border and in different parts of Mexico as well, you have to make sure that that stays there and that that doesn't come across. So I think those are important pieces. I think, you know, I've learned as a parent that I make a lot of decisions that affect my child, and my child is 7. And my child has really no opportunity at all to weigh in on the decisions that his mother and I make. And so it's very hard for me to argue for a system that holds the father's sins against the son. So as an example, I would be very supportive of the DREAM Act, because those kids who are here and have been here for a while, they're here through no fault, no decision of their own, and shouldn't be penalized for it. Parents' decisions, you know, if they've finished school and done everything that they're supposed to do, again, the American experiment in democracy looks for, or should look for, the very finest that our world, our globe has to offer. And those could be some people. Those are people, in many instances, that are writing up accounts.
Okay. Let's talk about the economy. It's starting to get better. There's been positive economic news lately. People are starting to feel like things are turning around. What policies, what legislation would you want to pursue or support in Congress that would help keep the economic recovery going?
You know, what I'm interested in, the kinds of things that I'm interested in, is making sure that the government is of assistance to small business. Because, frankly, so many times government is focused on big business because they may have an individual large corporation may have a significant number of employees. But in most of the congressional district, as an example, most of the business people are small businesses. They have less than, 20, 30 employees in that range. And in fact, if you're in Alpine, Texas, and you have 20 employees, you're not a small business. You're probably one of the bigger businesses in town. So the opportunities to help people like my dad, who owned a small restaurant, to make the government more accountable and easier to deal with in not only its regulations for health and safety, but its regulations on tax and giving these small businesses an opportunity to compete and to grow their business and become big businesses. Those are the kinds of things that I would be very focused on. I'm very interested in constituent service, and I'm very interested in stuff on the local level and helping individual people and real people and impacting quality of life. And so my focus is, it's not so much the D.C. And the global vision as much as it would be, at least in the short term, the micro vision of how can we create jobs for Congressional District 23? How can we help retain jobs for Congressional District 23? Because frankly, there's so many places across the district where we have people that would love to come and move there. We have people that are happy to come back, but they wonder what they would do to make a living for their families. So creating can make a living for their families and they can come back to that area. That would be my first priority.
There's been a lot of attention paid to inequalities in the tax code. Who pays how much, who's not paying enough. What's your view on that?
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of the flat tax. I'm a proponent, really, of everybody doing their fair share. I mean, I really do understand from my own experience that those of us who have been fortunate, we have a bigger obligation, or there's a bigger expectation of those to whom much is given, much is expected. And I think that our tax code should reflect those priorities for those of us who, to whom God has been fortunate and we've had opportunities that others have not had. We should be conscious of those opportunities, and we ought to be about not necessarily, you know, I don't advocate the, it's not that you hand out, it's that you create opportunities for others so that everybody gets the opportunity to climb the ladder. So I think there's some things that you could do in the tax code that would incentivize small business to create more, which would help people. I think there's some opportunities that you could do to help small businesses become bigger, which would help. And so, again, I mean, the it is unfortunate when you get to a place where you're talking about the haves and the have-nots. And so, in the short term, there is a very real fight, I think, to preserve the middle class, because you know, it is a shrinking class as a general rule. I mean, there's so many programs out there. If you're trying to send your kid to college, I can't tell you how many people have told me, you know, I make too much money to apply to qualify for my kid to get financial aid, and yet I don't have the money to send them myself. So there's more and more people falling in that divide, and I think that we have an obligation to do something about that, to strengthen the middle class, because the middle class has historically been the backbone of our country.
Well, if you're going to talk about higher education, I read a news article the other day that outstanding student loan debt has topped $1 trillion. That's obviously been a big barrier for, you know, young people trying to get started. Is that?
Well, I mean, it's hard enough to find a job, and then when you find a job, and it's even harder to find a job that's going to pay you enough to sustain two mortgages, as an example, because you're leaving school with a mortgage. I mean, that student loan debt, that's a, you know, some people, if you're leaving, you know, professional school, medical school, as an example, you may have $200,000 in debt, and that's a house. And so then when you're going to try to buy a house or trying to buy a car and you're trying to support two kids, I mean, the stress of that student loan is pretty significant. So what we can do and I think, frankly, that some good things have been done in terms of taking out the middleman and applying some more money at the federal level towards what in my day was called the National Direct Student Loan Program. I think that some progress has been made, but I definitely think there's more to do in that area, because the one thing that you want is that every kid who wants to go to college and is willing to work to get there, I think deserves the opportunity to be there.
You were, as I recall, critical of President Obama's compromise on the mandate to of employers to provide, you know, employers' insurance to provide birth control to all employees. Can you expound on that for me?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think there's certain there has to be some acknowledgement of what I would call you know, kind of a personal responsibility. If you go to work for the Catholic Church and you know the Catholic Church objects to certain things that they're in their fundamental philosophical tenets, then you probably shouldn't be working at the local Catholic Church. I think that's the example that I gave. And rather than force the church to offer something that is not in line with the church's teaching. Now, I will also tell you, though, that the truth is that I think there ought to be an opportunity individuals to obtain that additional health coverage at their own expense from their employers, if their employers have a philosophical objection to applying it. I guess the truth is that I don't see the world, as polar opposites. I mean, I think there's an equator. I think there's always middle ground. And the challenge for government, especially in modern times, has been to stake out and define that middle ground.
Okay. I thought that the compromise did allow religious organizations to not
in the end, I think in the end it worked out okay. But certainly what was being, and frankly, a lot of it is, that's the other problem I think that I have fundamentally, is I think nobody knows who to believe or what to believe, because there's so much hyperbole in politics. There's so much exaggeration in politics that nobody ever really knows. I mean, I still, one of my favorite pictures is a picture of a person who's at a demonstration on healthcare, and it says, get your government hands off my Medicare check. And it's just, it's a fundamental contradiction to me that, first of all, how can you get your government hands off of my Medicaid check when that's a government program? But obviously people didn't understand, or at least that person didn't understand. So our challenge is to make sure that the facts are all out there, that we kind of wean ourselves off of these spin machines from the right and the left, and throw the facts out there, and then let people decide on the merits of the argument.
All right. As you know, District 23 was one of the points of contention in the preclearance litigation. The litigation is still ongoing as we speak, and while we do have a map for 2012, it's likely there'll be further changes made. The current maps were largely the result of an agreement between the Texas Latino Redistricting Task Force and the state. Some other plaintiffs objected to it, but that's the compromise map that was adopted by the court. What's your opinion on the interim maps as they were adopted? Did they adequately address the issues that were raised in the litigation? And, what, if any, changes do you think should be made to District 23 as that litigation progresses?
Well, I will tell you that, mine is a simple analysis. I mean, it is what it is. The judges have told us that these are the district lines that we're going to use, and the fight is on. I mean, the race is on. So I expect that the D.C. court will weigh in at the appropriate time, and I believe that that they too will find that there were some voting rights issues with the congressional map, and so I expect that the legislature will be back at the drawing board in the next session of the legislature, and that as usual, District 23 will be crucial linchpins, I think, of that argument. But how it happens and who's in and who's out, I think, is a legislative determination. I'm working very hard in making sure that I reach out to all parts of the district. I mean, each iteration of the map had a different part of El Paso County, but, for my purposes, I'm campaigning in the part of El Paso County that's in there now. Bexar County is the same. Every time I looked at it, there was a different neighborhood in Bexar County, but it is what it is, and so I'm working there, and I was taught not to whine or complain, and if you have a map, then you work very hard and you try to get your message out, and people get the opportunity to choose their candidate, the candidate of their choice.
If after the nomination, after the primary, you're the nominee in District 23, President Obama calls you up and says, "Pete, I'd like to come down there and campaign with you." What would you say to him, and what would you like him to talk about in your district?
Well, My advice to him, frankly, would be to spend time in states that for him or for the National Democratic Party are a battleground. I don't know that his time is put at its best use in Texas. He doesn't carry Texas under any scenario that I can see. So, you know, my advice would be spend your time where you think you might be able to win, because you're not going to make any difference here. I will tell you that even 4 years ago when he was running, while many of the urban areas had an Obama, you know, what was called the Obama bump, those of us who ran in rural areas had an Obama backlash. I don't expect that will change in the rural areas. I do think, frankly, that there's going to be a bigger turnout, and I think that helps me significantly. I also think that it helps me significantly that I've always been the candidate who reaches out and gets literally very bipartisan support. I think the district that I represent now is significantly Republican and a very competitive district, and yet I've managed to hold on to it for a long time. And the way that I did that was by being reasonable and approachable and talking to everybody, telling them this is why I did what I did. And some people will disagree with it, but they'll at least respect me for sitting with them and explaining why I did what I did.
Okay. And when we do go to vote in May, you do have an opponent in the primary. Why should people vote to make you the nominee in Congressional District 23 and not your opponent?
Well, I think there are several differences. I hit the ground running because my legislative experience in passing legislation and working with people I think that helps me significantly. I think the bigger difference between Cito and I, as an example, who also has some legislative experience, is my even temperament. I mean, I am not particularly I'm not a good yeller, or I tend to be very low-key, very approachable, and it's pretty hard to annoy or irritate me. And I think it's very easy to get annoyed or irritated in Washington, D.C. So I think my boiling point and my level of patience is significantly higher. I think that's an advantage. I also, frankly, think that my skills as a mediator and conciliator, and as one who has brought warring factions together and been very persuasive in the argument, I think that is significant. And I will tell you that my driving passion is all bound up in the example that I'll give you is the 7 year old, because for me, I came to parenthood late in life. And I can't tell you how much my life changed on that day when I held this little 7 pound, 7 ounce kid. But it made me want to go out and make the world a better place for him. It made me want to go out and make the world a safer place for him. It made me want to go out and make sure that he had the kind of opportunities that I had and more. And that involves, if you want to make tomorrow better, that starts today. Monday night cannot be the busiest day of the week. So that's what drove me into running. I mean, the issues in D.C., that there doesn't seem to be any movement on. The fact that we are either right-wing or left-wing, when most people that I know, I mean, it's like flying on an airplane. I don't know too many people that get on an airplane and then go sit out on the left-wing or the right-wing. I think most people fly in the middle of the plane, looks at where the people are. And the challenge of our day is to get our leaders back in from the right wing and the left wing, and to get them back in the middle of the airplane while the people. And I think that's the skill that I have.
Okay. State Representative Pete Gallego, thank you very much for talking to me today.